Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Who We Are podcast. I am so excited to bring to you this episode because it's one of my favorite conversations so far. Relationships are a huge aspect of our lives, and today we delve into the complexities of relationships, love, and marriage with one of New York City's top divorce attorney, James Sexton. I have the privilege of sitting with James. He's a seasoned divorce attorney, author, and advocate for healthy relationships. He has over 2 decades of experience on the front lines of divorce and has witnessed the intricacies of countless relationships unraveling, providing him with a unique perspective on what it takes to build and maintain a lasting connection. In his book, How to Stay in Love, and also in today's episode, James offers candid insights, stories, and practical advice drawn from his experiences navigating the highs and lows of marriage and divorce. So join me as I embark on a journey of discovery with James Sexton, exploring the depths of human connection and the secrets to staying in love. It's a conversation you don't want to miss. James, for those of us who may not be as familiar as you, could you share with us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. So my name is James Sexton, and I'm a divorce lawyer in New York City. I've been practicing divorce law for 25 years, and I'm a courtroom lawyer. So I'm a very traditional type of lawyer who, you know, I started my practice 25 years ago doing very small divorces for very little money. It's grown now where I represent, you know, finance people in New York City, celebrities, sports, figures. So I'm very blessed that my career has grown and expanded over 25 years. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I just, on kind of a whim, I decided to write a book. And I thought, rather than write a book about the crazy things that I see as a divorce lawyer, and there's a lot of those.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something about what you could learn from those things. So I wrote a book called If You're in My Office, It's Already Too Late, A Divorce Lawyer's Guide to Staying Together. And that was later on made into paperback form. And actually, when they turned it paperback, they changed the title to How to Stay in Love, Practical Wisdom from an Unlikely Source. And the reason why they did that is my publisher found that the word divorce made people not want to buy a book. So it sold much better once it was named How to Stay in Love. But then I became something of an unlikely relationship advice person. The reason I wrote the book was that I think that when you watch things fall apart, you learn a lot about how to keep them together. And so I thought, well, you know, as a divorce lawyer, I get to see things in a really honest way. I get to see people's finances. I get to hear about things that they're maybe ashamed of, that they did, that they don't want anyone to know about, but now has become part of the divorce. So I have a very unique all-access perspective. And I felt like that perspective gave me the ability to say, hey, here's some things I see people struggling with. And unlike a psychologist or a politician who is kind of speculating about what problems they think people have, these are real things I see sitting in front of me. These are clients, people who I see struggling. So that's why I wrote the book. And then about a year ago, maybe a little less than that, one of the many interviews that I did went viral and had over 6 million views. And that led to a lot of additional media exposure. And now I do quite a bit of media work. I still have a full-time job. That's why I'm dressed like this. It's early here in New York. And I'm going to be heading off to work in a little while for a busy Monday. But I really love what I do. I love being a lawyer. I love being a divorce lawyer. But I also really am enjoying this chapter of my life where I have this other side job, I guess, where I'm talking to people about relationships.
And where you almost get to give back and share your learnings, you know, from what you've witnessed. You've spent years on the front lines of divorce, witnessing firsthand the breakdowns of countless of marriages. Can you discuss, you know, what are some of the underlying reasons you think why so many marriages are failing in today's society?
Yeah, that's the most important question, I think. And, you know, the answer I always think of for that question is there are big things, and everyone mm-hmm. thinks about the big things. Everyone thinks about infidelity, financial misconduct, those kinds of lying and cheating. But to me, those are actually symptoms, not causes. Those are not the disease. Those are the side effects of the disease. The disease, I think, is disconnection. I think that we fall in love very fast. You know, we see a romantic partner and we feel something, you know, and it's sudden, you know, it's attraction. It's all those wonderful things. We fall in love fast, but we fall out of love slowly from what I see. And almost the way that people go bankrupt, which is very slowly and then all at once. You know, it's mm-hmm. like a very slow disconnection. And I think that, you know, if we're honest with ourselves and we think about, when do I feel loved? When have I felt loved by my partner? It's really small things for most people. You know, for most people, the things that make you feel most loved are very small gestures. It's your partner putting their hand on your shoulder at the end of the day. It's your partner making your coffee for you in the morning. It's your partner remembering that there's a food that you like and bringing it or giving it to you. Mm. It's just these small gestures of love, and they're everything, but they're so small that it's probably easy to forget that you do them. And the world, you know, we're all so busy. We're all so exhausted so much of the time. There's so many responsibilities. And of course, when families have children and, you know, elderly family members to deal with, we all have so many things, so many balls we're juggling in the air, that it's easy to forget these little things, you know, these little kindnesses that we show to our partner, these little signs of affection. And we don't realize, but it starts to disconnect. And that's when the conditions are created for those big things to happen. Because we don't realize it, but suddenly we feel lonely. And we don't know why we feel lonely. And I think the way I compare it to gaining weight. You know, you don't just eat a birthday cake and the next day you're heavy, you know, you become, it really is lots of small decisions. And one day your suits don't fit anymore. And you say, well, what happened? You know, well, what happened was a long time. And it's easier to stay a healthy weight than it is to gain a whole bunch of weight and then try to lose all of it. And that's what I think we do in this culture is we try to, you know, we don't pay a lot of attention to our relationship. We say, all right, I've got that now. I don't need to worry about that anymore. I have a husband. I have a wife. I don't have to worry about that anymore. There's lots of other things to worry about. And then what happens is it starts to disconnect and disconnect and disconnect. And by the time we realize, oh, we're really like in different places now.
Yeah.
It's much harder to get back to where you were. You know, when you were happy, when you were connected, because it's like gaining a whole bunch of weight. And now you go, oh my God, I have to lose all that weight. It's going to be hard. It's going to take a long time. So I really, my goal in my work is to encourage people, whether they're at the start of a relationship or whether they're just in a place where they're, you know, having a good connection with their partner, or if they're in a tough place, if they can get back to a healthy, happy connection, how to just stay there. How to just stay in that good place and never get too far from that good place. Because it's amazing to me how little attention we pay to something as important as our marriage. You know, if you buy a house or an apartment, you don't say, well, I own this now. I don't have to take care of it anymore. I can let it fall apart. I own it. I don't have to worry about that. It's mine. I don't have to. Forget
no maintenance,
it.
No
one would do that. Of course, you'd say, hey, I own this. I should take good care of it. It's mine. You know, when something is mine, I should take good care of it. And I should protect it and make sure that it stays useful and stays, you know, healthy. Well, this is the same thing with marriage. It should not be, oh, I have my spouse. I don't need to worry about that. Now I can put all of my attention on all the other things. Because there will always be other things. There will always be other things that need our attention. And that it's easy to say, well, I don't owe my spouse that. Like, I don't owe them you know, a pat on the back at the end of a tough day. I don't owe them, you know, affection and attention. You're right. You don't. You don't owe them that. But if you want to be happy, then it's not about what you owe each other. It's about what can we do to stay connected to each other? What can we do to make this other person feel loved and feel valuable and feel like we're cheering for them? And hopefully they give us that same energy back.
Wow, I love it, because these things, the seemingly trivial things, they compound and they build up. And even in your book, you know, How to Stay in Love, Practical Wisdom from an Unlikely Source, you also suggest that, you know, the seemingly trivial issues can signal deeper problems in a relationship. What are some examples of these warning signs, and how can we as couples address them before they escalate?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, that's the key, right? Is to how do we see the smoke before it becomes a fire? Because once it's a fire, it's almost too late. So I think there's lots of little ones. And I think the most qualified people to find them are the people in the relationship. Because each of us, you know, in our relationships, those small things are very small and unique to us. You know, it might be that your spouse at the end of a phone call tells you that they love you. It might be that you would go to bed, you know, at a certain time together. It might be that you would have breakfast together or dinner together. It might be something silly and simple. I give examples in my book, like there was a woman who said her husband would buy a particular type of granola cereal for her.
Yeah.
It can be all kinds of things. It can be physical connection, you know, it can be sex. It can be how much sex did we have when we were first married, and now it's some years later, and are we letting that slip and disappear? Maybe because we have children and other things we have to tend to. So, you know, I guess the best baseline, I think, for a couple is when it was good, when we were happy, what were we doing? You know, if you've gained a bunch of weight, you have to think, well, when I was in good shape, what was I eating? What exercise was I doing? Okay, what's different now? You know, I'm exercising less. I'm eating sugary foods. Okay, there's your answer. You know, you have to change that. So I think it's going to be unique to every couple. But what I would always encourage people to think about is it may be very small things. And by the way, there's value in having this discussion with your partner, because I think it's very surprising. You know, when I have said to my romantic partner, you know, like, when do you feel loved by me? I am shocked by the answer. It's usually not the grand gestures you'd think it would be, you know, that time you took me on this wonderful vacation, or that you brought me roses on Valentine's Day, or that you know, it's strange things when we celebrated the holidays with my family and you let my father give the toast at dinner because you wanted to let him be the man of the house.
Wow.
And I go, I just did that because that's how I was raised. Like, I didn't show, oh my God, I loved that. You know, you go, oh, okay. I had no idea, you know, one of the examples I give is, I encourage men to leave a note for their wife, you know, in the morning. So when they go to work or wherever they're going, so just leave a short note, you know, just simple, like, you know, thanks for spending the evening with me last night. You know, I'm so glad I married the prettiest girl in the world, you know? And what does that take? 5 seconds?
Much. Yeah.
5 seconds, you know? But it makes us feel loved. It makes us feel special. Wow. To tell, you know, when is the last time? People should ask themselves, when is the last time I told my wife how pretty she is, how lucky I am to have her? When is the last time you told your husband, you're so handsome, you're so kind, you're so lovely, I'm so lucky to have a big, strong man like you? We all want the same thing. You know, when a man opens the pickle jar, you know, we feel like a champion, you know, and it's because that's what we want to be. We want to be a champion. And so much of the world is just telling us that we're not. And so to have our partner cheering for us. You know, women, so many women are told they're doing it wrong. Everything they're doing. Like if they're working and a mother, it's like, well, you're not that good of a mother and you're not that good at work. You could be better at both. And even no matter how beautiful they are, there's someone else, you know, selling a skin cream on the TV commercial that is perhaps more beautiful or younger or whatever. So we all love the feeling of knowing that our partner is cheering for us and that they would choose us again and again and again. And I think that is such a simple thing to do, but it requires that you see these small changes that are happening. And when we're slowly disconnecting, I mean, if you do it right, you never have to disconnect. You really don't. You can always err on the side of connection. Because again, what if it's just that simple? You know, the advertisers like to tell people that you have to buy something or you have to do something, you know, big. Usually something you have to spend money on, you know, but sometimes the answer is much more simple than that. Like, what if it's just that simple? What if it's just a kind word? What if it's just a small gesture of love? What if it's just paying attention, that we don't need to buy anything? We don't need to go anywhere. We just need to treat our partner with the love and affection and kindness that we want someone to treat us with, our partner to treat us with. I think it might be that simple.
Wow. And it's all about, and I mean, to me, you know, what I'm hearing is also like regular check-ins with our partners and regular expressing of love, you know, on a regular basis and from the slightest and smallest things.
I think they say measure what matters. And so if something matters, you should measure it. So you pay attention to it. You know, if you're trying to watch your health and your weight, you weigh yourself every day or you weigh yourself once a week because you measure what matters. And I think it's the same thing. How do we measure our relationship? Well, the best way to do it is to talk to our partner, to have, like you said, regular check-ins, you know, whether that's a certain day or night of the week where you go for a walk with your partner and you talk about these things, whether it's sending an email to each other. I give a lot of suggestions in the book about just different ways that you can keep connection with your partner. And when something happens that makes you feel disconnected, how do you talk to your partner about it without attacking them or making them feel attacked? Because none of us like to feel attacked. You know, if you say to your partner, the example that I give in the book, you might recall, is I was dating a woman and I, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I have to dress the part of a lawyer and I shave every morning. I have to look very clean cut. And I dated a girl on the weekends. I like to not shave because it's like I have to do it every day during the week. And it's nice to give my face a break and not have to shave. But my beard grows pretty fast and it's a little rough of a beard. So I was dating a woman. And when I went to like kiss her, she would say, oh, your beard is so scratchy. You know, I don't like it. And I immediately got very defensive, you know, and I didn't say it out loud, but I felt like, well, you know, like I have to shave all week and this is my chance to have a couple days where I don't have to. And you should be happy that I'm kissing you. You know, you should be happy that I want to kiss you. Like, what? Why are you going to make me feel bad that I didn't shave? Yeah. So it wasn't a great way to handle things. That relationship didn't work out. But an interesting thing is the next woman that I dated, she had the same thing. She didn't like when my beard was scratchy. But she was much smarter in terms of how she handled it. What happened is I would shave in the morning and then I would go to give her a kiss and she would say, oh, I love when your face is clean shaven like that. It's so smooth and it's so handsome. It feels so good on my skin. Well, I'm a man. I'm not stupid. I would shave 3 times a day. I would shave and then I would come in the room and I'd say, oh, did you see? I just shaved, you know, like it. And because I didn't feel defensive. She was focusing on what I liked, you know, and instead of saying what I'm doing wrong. And no one likes to be criticized. No one likes to be told they're doing it wrong. So why not praise what's right with your partner? Why not tell your husband or your wife, instead of saying, oh, I hate when all you do is make vegetables for dinner. Why not say, oh, this meat that you made is so delicious. Oh, your chicken. No one has ever cooked chicken as delicious as you. She's going to make chicken for you all the time. Like the more that you tell someone, this is so, when you do this, it's so wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a great way to, you know, the other example I give, because a lot of my examples are about things like, you know, in a marriage or in a romantic relationship, you know, people often struggle with how do I tell my spouse that I want something different when it comes to sex or something happening in bed between us. And people feel like, you know, well, it's hard to bring that up and it's hard to say, oh, you know, I want something different in our relationship sexually. And I always tell people, like, there's a way to say that, that a person's going to feel very defensive. Well, how come we don't do this anymore?
Yeah.
Oh, you used to do this and you don't do it anymore. You know, instead, you can say something like, you know, oh, I had a dream about you last night. Oh, my gosh. I don't even want to say. Wait, what was it? I want to know. What was it? No. I'm almost embarrassed. It was like, I don't know what happened. I ate ice cream before I went to sleep and I had this crazy dream. No. Tell me what it was. And then you tell your partner what it is that you were thinking about. Mm-hmm. And if they say, oh, well, I would never want to do that. You say, I know. It's just a crazy dream. I don't. Or they might say, well, you know, would you like, is that something you might like? Well, I don't know. Maybe, I guess, you know, I had a dream about it. It was pretty nice. And that's a way to non-defensively get into that discussion. And I know people are probably hearing this and saying, oh, well, why should you have to do that? What are we, children? You can't just talk to your partner. Look, we're human.
Yeah.
We're human. The way you ask a question sometimes determines the answer. You know, the way you approach something is going to affect how it's received. So I don't think there's anything dishonest about that any more than is a woman wearing makeup lying? No, it's not lying. It's accentuating the positive. It's diminishing the negative, and it's just shining a light on the best. And that's what I encourage people to do. I don't think
Amazing.
It's dishonest at all.
I love it. And it's really a reminder, especially when it comes to communication, to really dial up and focus and emphasize on the good and then pay less attention and don't criticize the bad, especially. And I think that is something that we all can learn from. You know, in your book, you also talk about the concept of reverse engineering, especially when it comes to relationships, to identify and address underlying issues. Can you explain and tell us a little bit more about this approach and how can we apply it in real life situations?
Yeah, the way that I've often described reverse engineering is, my mother used to say something when I was a kid. She used to say that it's hard to define intelligence, but you can spot stupid from a mile away. So what is intelligent other than not a lot of stupid? Right? I'm not doing a lot of stupid things. So I think reverse engineering relationships is about what makes us feel unloved, what makes us feel disconnected, what makes us feel hurt and lonely, and figuring out, okay, what's the opposite of that, right? Because that's really the key, is to think about when we've felt unloved by our partner, when our partner is disconnecting from us, what's going on at that time? And then think about what's the opposite of that thing. Because it's very easy to get frustrated with, well, what am I supposed to do? You know, what am I supposed? Well, if you know what not to do, then the opposite is the best thing. I have a friend who is a sommelier, you know, he's a wine expert.
Yeah.
And I was having a conversation with him once about how do you teach people what's the best wine to go with a food. And he said, the biggest mistake most people make is when they're learning about wine, they try to figure out what wine goes best with what food. But actually, the best way to learn is to have the wrong wine. Because when you have the wrong wine, you realize, oh yeah, this doesn't work. You know, like if you have a Cabernet with sushi, you're not even going to taste the sushi because the wine is too big and too bold. If you have a very soft Chardonnay with a steak. It's, you're not even going to taste the wine. It's good. So he said, what is good is hard to notice, but what's bad is easy to see. And so I think reverse engineering in relationships is very much about that. Look at what either in your relationship or in the relationships around you, look at what people are doing that makes them feel disconnected, that takes them further from each other, that makes others look at the relationship and think, you know, this is not a relationship that is likely to sustain. Mm-hmm. And then what is the opposite of that thing? And try to steer yourself into the opposite.
Yeah, I think that is good advice and almost sounds like such common sense, you know, that a lot of times we don't really think about it that way.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think we all want to believe there is some wisdom out there and that we just have to find it, you know, but sometimes the simplest wisdom is the greatest wisdom, you know, and that's why I always say, what if it's that easy? Like, what if it's just pay attention, try to make your partner feel valuable. And, you know, people say to me often, well, why should I make my partner feel that way? They don't make me feel that way. You know, why should I be nice to them? They're not being nice to me. But that's a guarantee of just a downward spiral, you know? And it can work the other way, which is be kind, be compassionate, be affectionate, even if your partner isn't being those things. And give it some time. Because look, if you give your partner affection, attention, love, connection, and after time you realize they are not giving it back to me ever, then that's when you end up in my office because you've done what you can do. Yeah. But in my experience, most couples, when they make a conscious effort, the other person, I had a man come up to me in the street in New York City a few weeks ago, and he recognized me from my media stuff. And he said, "You're that lawyer." And I said, "Yes." He said, "I read your book." He said, "It changed my whole marriage." And I said, "Really?" Because I was fascinated. I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I started leaving my wife notes in the morning." Aww. And I thought, well, I'll just try this. And I said, "So how did it go?" And he said, "Well, the first day or two, she was really worried. She called me. She said, what's this note? What's going on? Why did you leave this note? Like, what are you doing?"
You must have
And I said, "Nothing. I just am trying to remember to tell you more often the things I don't always say." And she said, "Are you sure something's not wrong? Are you sick? Or are you cheating on me? What's going on?" And he said, "No, I'm just trying something different." And he said, for a week or so, it wasn't much of a difference. He said, but slowly, like, she started being, he's like, we would sit on the couch and she would move a little closer to me. And he said, that made me feel in the morning, like, more like, oh, I can't wait to leave her a note. It was exciting because it was like, I wonder what I'll get next. And, you know, then he said, yeah. And then I ended up bringing her home flowers one night. And then over the weekend, she made my favorite meal. And it's, all that is that same downward spiral, just reversing, because it's so easy and understandable that, well, you know, this, my partner wasn't nice to me, so I'm not going to be nice to them. Well, they didn't leave me anything, so I'm not going to leave them anything. Well, they didn't try to kiss me, so I'm not going to try to kiss them. And now everybody's just miserable. Whereas if you go the other way with it, you know, that same phenomenon can move in the other direction. And that's a beautiful thing when it happens. So I've had a lot of people write me about that. And it's great.
It's beautiful. And it's so worth trying, right? And I love what you said, right? At least for us, even if at the end of the day, it doesn't work out, we leave knowing that we have tried our best to do something about it. How do you think, James, societal norms and expectations contribute to the challenges couples face in maintaining healthy relationships today? And what advice do you have for us in navigating these pressures?
Yeah. I think, you know, we live in an ecosystem, an environment, right, where it's not just us, it's family systems, it's work, it's community, it's societal gender roles. It's so many things. And sometimes, you know, the first thing I would encourage everyone to do is to see them. Mm-hmm. You know, whoever discovered water, it probably wasn't a fish. Like a fish, just that's all they know is water. They don't see it. And so I think for many of us, we don't realize what is our heart and what is our culture, what is our community, what is our gender role, what is... So it's really important to just see those. First, just see them. I'm not saying run away from them. I'm not saying embrace them. Just see them. Just identify them. Because I often say that tradition is, in some ways, the lessons we learn from other humans in history, right? Mm-hmm. So if your grandmother cooked something a particular way, it's probably because that's the best way to do it, you know? And if your mother cooks it a certain way because your grandmother cooked it a certain way, you can be pretty sure that, okay, this is probably the right way to do this thing. But you also have to remember, tradition is also peer pressure from dead people. You know, tradition is also sometimes your grandmother did it that way because, I don't know, that's just the way she did it.
Yeah.
And it's, she didn't have the same tools that you have. She didn't have such a lovely stove as you have. So you have to ask the question first, like, is this the best way to do this? Or is this just the way that people used to do it? Because sometimes the way people used to do it is the right way to do it. And they did it that way because they saw the mistakes. Like, humans haven't changed that much. I don't care where you live. I don't care what century you're living in. We want many of the same things. We want to eat. We want to sleep. We want to reproduce. We want love and affection and connection. We get frightened. We all have these things in common. So asking yourself first, what is me and what is everything around me is really important. And then also not allowing outside pressure to define your relationship. Because really the only two people that need to be happy in a marriage are the two people in that marriage. So there shouldn't be a feeling of, well, what's everyone else doing? What's everyone else? How much sex are other people having? How many gifts do they buy each other? How often does it really matter? Because the answer should be, if we're both happy, the two people in this relationship, and we both think there's enough, whether it's enough affection, sex, love, compliments, anything, time together. Like, I know couples that don't sleep in the same room, that they're very in love, they're very happy, but they also are very serious about getting some rest.
Yeah.
And they say, you know what? You sleep in this room, and if the kids wake up, tonight will be your night that you have to help tend to them. And I'm going to get a really good night's sleep. And then tomorrow we'll switch. And many couples, if you propose that to them, would say, well, you can't do that. Why? Well, because you can't. Right. But why? Mm. Well, because if you're not sleeping in the same room, it means you don't love each other. Does it? Does it really? Like, who said that? Like, who told you that? Because that doesn't, sleeping in the same room doesn't mean you love each other. Can we all agree on that? Like, there are people that are sleeping in the same room, in the same bed, that hate each other. We can all agree. Okay.
Yeah.
So we know that where you sleep is not necessarily proof of who you love. Okay. So if that's possible, isn't it also possible that you could be very happily in love and sleep in separate rooms? So this is just a question of, again, first identifying what is me, what is my partner, and what are these other elements, cultural, political, social, familial, you know, from generation to generation. Yeah. And then which fit us? Because again, throwing it all out and saying we're going to do it however we want to do it, that's silly. Like, why learn? Like, there are lessons to be learned from history. There are lessons to be learned from our parents and grandparents. Sometimes the lesson is don't do what they did. Do it different, because the way they did it was not healthy, was not good. But sometimes the lesson is, okay, they saw something I don't see. They know something I don't know. Mm. So I think that's a key piece, is to be fearless in adopting or changing traditions.
Wow. James, what advice do you have for individuals who may be hesitant to seek counseling or therapy for relationship issues, particularly in Asia, where it may still be quite a taboo?
Yeah, it's a cultural difference. You know, in the United States in recent years, there's been a real movement to normalize therapy, you know, to encourage people to talk to someone. And, you know, that ideally would be a professional. That would be someone who, you know, is a therapist and is trained in these things. That's so much easier to access now with, you know, online services. You can have video conferencing. It's so much more accessible. But even if it's just, you know, women's groups or men's groups together, even if it's a close friend or confidant, sharing openly and honestly, think about your friendships. You know, how many friendships do you just do the silly, how are you? I'm good. How are you? Oh, I'm good. Everything's good. Yeah, everything's good. And how many friendships do you have that, so how are you? You know, like this week was hard. I'm having it. Really, what's going on? Tell me, you know, that kind of friendship is gold. Like that's the, I mean, I think counseling is important. Therapy is important. I'm a big fan of it. I think that it really helps people grow. And I think when we think about therapy, not as, okay, there's something wrong with me and I need to fix it.
Professional help. But
it's really just having someone who's not in your life at all and has no reason. They have no agenda. You know, like if your friend tells you something, your friend's in the situation. They might know your spouse. They might, you know, want to like steer a certain way. Whereas a person who has no connection to your life, their only job is to protect you, try to help you, and to keep all your secrets. And you can tell them anything. That's a really valuable resource. So I think that therapy can be a huge help for people. And again, because that's confidential and private, that isn't something you have to share with anyone if you feel any embarrassment culturally or personally about it. But even if you don't make that jump, just having connection with other people, I think is very important. Honest connection, because we have so many
superficial
kinds of connections with people where we just pretend everything's great, even when we know there's issues happening for us. And again, I understand. I don't walk around telling everyone my deepest feelings. You know, I don't, you know, when I go to the grocery store and they say, how you doing? I don't say, well, I've been a little sad lately. You know, fine. Thank you. Have a nice day. But I really do try.
Yeah.
In my close relationships, because there's something so lovely and beautiful about when you say to someone something you didn't want to say out loud, you know, like, yeah, I feel like a failure lately. You know, I worry I'm a bad father sometimes. And they go, oh yeah, I've been there. Like, I know what that feels like. I feel that way too sometimes. Just that.
Wow.
Feels so, oh, thank God. I'm not the only one. Wow. Like, I'm not the only one who feels that way sometimes. I'm not the only one who struggles with this. And so I think there's tremendous value in that. And it's, look, you know, if you're not scared, it's not brave. Like, it's only brave if you're scared and you do it anyway. And I think we're all capable of being very brave. And we just have to try. We just have to try to be. Again, I always tell people, anything I recommend people do is always a very low investment. Like, I'm not asking anybody, okay, sell your house and go do this. Like, my advice is leave a note. Does that take 3 seconds?
Yeah.
Have one appointment with a therapist. See how it feels. Commit to 30 days. 30 days where you're going to try to be very kind to your spouse, you know, or go to therapy for 3 weeks, 4 weeks. What's the cost? If it doesn't, okay, so no harm. It's not like it's going to kill you, you know, just give it a try and see if there's value in your life.
Wow. How can individuals rebuild their confidence and sense of self-worth after a divorce, especially if they feel like they've lost a part of themselves in the process?
Yeah, that's such an important question. You know, I think you said it really well, that you feel like you lose a part of yourself when you lose a relationship, when a relationship ends. And I think that's partly because culturally, we all, in almost every culture I know, we view relationships as success or failure. And I don't know that that's the best way to approach it. I think approaching it like chapters in a long book is a healthier way to look at things. Like you learn something from every relationship that you're in. And sometimes what you learn is what you don't want. And sometimes what you learn is how you don't want to feel. Mm-hmm. And that's very useful information. You know, I think when we're honest with ourselves about the lessons we've learned from failure, they're often the most powerful and important lessons. So I don't see that as failure. If it is the birthplace of success, eventual mm-hmm. success, is it really a failure? So I really believe that you know, when we fall in love, one of the powerful emotions that come with love, and it's one of the reasons why people have so many affairs, you know, why infidelity happens, is how you feel about yourself when you're having an affair. Mm. Because when you have an affair, there's something empty inside of you, right? You don't feel loved, you don't feel desirable, you don't feel handsome or beautiful. And this person notices you. They think you're beautiful, they think you're handsome, they think you're successful, interesting, entertaining, all the things that your spouse used to think about you mm. when they met you. And you start to feel those things again. This person thinks I'm beautiful, so I feel beautiful again, you know? And that cuts both ways, because when a relationship ends, we feel like, wait, this person doesn't think I'm beautiful anymore, so maybe I'm not beautiful anymore. But the truth of your beauty, the truth of your success, the truth of your value is inherent. It's not subjective. It's not tied to someone else. Someone else noticing it is a lovely feeling. It always will be. It always will be. There's literally no time in life that someone comes up to me and says, I think you're very handsome, that I go, ugh. You know, like, that's wonderful. I don't care who it is. I don't care who it is. It could be anybody. I'll be happy to hear. Thank you very much. That's lovely. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So mm-hmm. I think it's very important to realize that we fall in love not only with a person, but with how that person makes us see ourselves. They see beauty in us, so we see beauty in ourselves. They see value in us, so we see value in ourselves. But seeing beauty and value in yourself, free from another person's view of you, is really one of the most powerful lessons that you can ever learn. Because if you radiate that beauty, radiate that love, radiate that confidence, then that opens the door to all kinds of new connections and new chapters in life. I have been doing this job for 25 years, and I have had so many people sit in front of me, and they're certain that their life is over. It's over. Their husband came home and said, I don't love you anymore. I've met someone else, and leaves. And they have three children, and they cry at my table, and my life is over. It'll never be the same ever again. Everything's ruined. And 5 years later, 10 years later, I'm going to their next wedding. Wow. Or they're having another baby with their new husband or wife. And I've reached the point in my career, it's a beautiful thing to see, where sometimes I'll take like a new client who's in that situation, and I'll call an old client from 10 years ago who was in that situation. And I'll say, mm-hmm. can I give this person your phone number and have them call you? And 99% of the time, the client says, absolutely. Yeah, wow. Have them call me. And I'll say to the old client, look, this person is right where you were. They're actually sitting in the same chair you were sitting in 10 years ago. And they're in the same place emotionally. And I know I can tell them, but you can tell them much more powerfully. Mm. And almost always the old client will say, yeah, sure. Put them in touch with me. And then the new client will call me after they've spoken to them and say, oh my God, we talked for 2 hours. Like it was so lovely. Like I feel so much better to know that like this person made it through this situation. And I think that kind of sharing is so important. I see it now as a man in his 50s, you know, when I have a lot of young men who work for me in their 30s and 40s, and you know, some of them have young children. And I try to be really, really honest with them about, oh, I remember being really frustrated, you know, when I had kids that age. Oh, I remember, you know, it was really hard to do. And I think sometimes like they're shocked by how much I know of their life, because my life was like that. But we're just not sharing it as openly. So I think, again, the key is to be fearless. And to be fearless in your relationship, to be fearless in your relationship to the world, to be radically honest. You know, I'm not saying you have to walk around and tell everybody everything, but overcome, like, the world will be a better place if we're all just a little more vulnerable and a little more brave.
Wow. And my last question, James, is, you know, what advice would you give to your younger self, knowing what you know now about love, marriage, and navigating relationships?
I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question. It's a great question. I think the advice I would give to my younger self is to not be so hard on myself. I think I would tell my younger self, I think most people would probably say this, I would tell my younger self to not be so afraid that things work out even when they go wrong. That sometimes when it feels like the world is ending, it's really just the beginning of something new and beautiful. And that some of the things that you think are going to work out won't, and that's okay. And some of the things that you think won't work out will, and that's okay. So I see a lot, as I said before, I'm in my 50s now. I'm 52. And I see a lot, my sons are in their 20s, and I have a lot of young men who work for me in their 30s and 40s. And I would never go backwards. Like I look at each of those chapters, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and I have a special love for all of those chapters in my life. And I have some really, you know, I have some wonderful memories of each of those chapters, and I have some parts of each of those chapters that I go, oh, thank God I'm done with that. And so I would never go backwards, you know, and I hope when I'm in my 60s, I look at my 50s and go, oh, that was nice, but I wouldn't go back. But yeah, I think I would just tell myself to not be so hard on myself, to do my best. And the only thing I would probably say to my younger self is, you know, don't take your eyesight and your back not hurting for granted. You're very lucky. Like if you wake up in the morning and your back doesn't hurt and you don't need reading glasses, you're 10 steps ahead of the game, you know?
To treasure those days, yeah.
Yeah, to treasure that. You know, youth is wasted on the young, you know? They don't always see how good they have. You know, I often say this to people, that if you've ever had a toothache, you know, a bad toothache, all you can think about is that your tooth hurts. Mm-hmm. And you think, if I could just have this tooth not hurt, everything in life would be fine. Everything would be good. And then you go to the dentist and your tooth stops hurting. Mm. And for about a day, you're just, oh, I don't have a toothache anymore. It's so great. Okay. Well, you didn't wake up today and go, well, I don't have a toothache. It's a great day. I don't have a toothache. But, you know, you could wake up today and say, hey, you know what? I don't have a backache. I don't have a toothache. I'm 10 steps ahead of the game.
Wow.
Like, I'm so lucky right now. I mean, think about that. Like when we're in the presence of death, we value life. When we're in the presence of illness, we value health. When we're in the presence of you know, breaking up and bad relationships, we value our love and our relationships. So why not do that now? Why not do that every day? Why not be grateful that you don't have a toothache today?
Wow.
Because you're very lucky. You're very lucky. Like your partner, their love, you don't own it. It's loaned to you. Even your partner, they're loaned to you. Like you don't own them. They're loaned to you from God, from the universe, whatever. They're loaned to you. And so approach that with gratitude. Approach that with reverence for the miracle that it is. And I think all of our lives would be better.